This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Humans already have an unbelievable capacity to alter our own genetic codes. Mutations that cause disease can now simply be snipped and replaced. And now scientists are turning an eye to ever more far-reaching gene editing technologies that will enable us to permanently alter the traits that certain species can pass on to their offspring. These advances promise revolutionary approaches to health and agriculture, but they raise questions, like who should have access to gene editing tools and what kind of regulation should govern them. Todd Kuchen is a senior research scholar at North Carolina State University's Genetic Engineering and Society Center, and he's been looking into the promise and pitfalls of synthetic biology, and he joins us now. Welcome, Todd.
Thanks for having me.
Let's find out where we are. Well, first of all, let's talk about synthetic biology. I just said it like I knew what I was talking about.
Sure.
Tell me what I said.
So synthetic biology is maybe just the term of the day or a term of art. It's just sort of the next generation of genetic techniques or genetic engineering techniques that scientists are able to utilize that's really bringing in an engineering discipline to biology.
All right, so let's talk about something that we may all be familiar with, CRISPR. This is a particular gene editing technique,
that's
right?
That's correct.
So let's talk about that, and there are a couple of others out there as well.
Sure.
But let's use that one and tell us what we can do with it.
Sure. So what CRISPR enables you to do is actually to make those edits inside the genome, right, at very specific locations, and not just at one particular location, at multiple locations, in a very precise way. And what's sort of revolutionary about the technique is that it's easier, right? So I'm putting up my fictitious finger quotes there compared to sort of the previous techniques. So if you think about sort of what traditional genetic engineering, like a GMO plant, for instance, mm-hmm. in essence, what scientists were doing were importing those genes or blasting that one genetic trait into a plant species. What CRISPR enables you to do is to make those edits inside the genome itself. Internally, so in essence, changing the internal code of those genes.
And because we've mapped the genome, we sort of know what we're looking for, and now we've begun to focus on certain pathologies. So we say, we know this one, and when it looks like that in there, we understand that a certain disease is very likely to happen. Let's change it.
Yes, that's the theory, right? So as sort of computer algorithms have also sort of come online, this is sort of where the engineering and also computer engineering disciplines come into play as well. You can now literally sit at a desktop and sort of engineer the genetic code that you think you want. And then using techniques such as CRISPR, you can then eventually make that happen or attempt to make that happen.
All right. And right now, it's actually been used. There's been some human trials, and these techniques, this and something called ZFNs, which is harder to use, but I'm told a little bit more accurate. They've already been used to help control disease in certain individuals in testing, right? So it's out
there.
That's
correct. Yes, right? these techniques are definitely out there. CRISPR, for instance, is used in most genetic labs now, including community biotech labs.
I'm going to talk about that in a minute because I love the idea of citizen science and particularly when it comes to this technology. But I want to look just for a moment at more of the promise at the moment. So in humans, detecting and then correcting disease process, it's also been used, I think, in embryos to detect, to prevent disease from, from a child from being born with a particular defect, if that's what's happening. But also in nature, for instance, malaria. How would that work, for instance, if we wanted to?
Right. So one of the promises, so to speak, that people are looking at utilizing CRISPR is to deal with disease vectors, right? So malaria is transmitted by mosquitoes. So if you could utilize these techniques for instance, to engineer in a genetic trait that would either make all of the offspring infertile, for instance, over time, that population of mosquitoes could potentially die out. Another potential option that NC State is a partner with is looking at invasive rodents on islands and whether or not you could, in essence, drive some of these genetic traits through the population of, say, island mice that aren't supposed to be there. All of their offspring become male. Over time, that population dies, and in theory, have eliminated that invasive species from a particular island.
Now, invasive species opens the question of unintended consequences.
That's correct.
we thought we would control the population of snakes with a mongoose and however that whole story went. And then, of course, we've got a problem with the predator. why can't the same thing happen with genetic engineering?
So the same thing could happen. So that is, in essence, what the Genetic Engineering and Society Center is attempting to sort of look at, right? So we've sort of integrated not just the science and technology developers, but also the social scientists, economists, ecologists, political scientists, to look at sort of the broad questions about not just if you can use this technology in terms of if you can actually develop it, because something like a gene drive, for instance, hasn't actually been fully developed yet. But let's
say, what did you just say?
Gene drive, right? Yeah. So if you look at what we were talking about with CRISPR and you're able to make that genetic edit, what a gene drive enables you to do is then to drive that trait through the population using sexual reproduction.
Ooh,
right? So that chain becomes permanent. Right. And that's where you can then get these populations to sort of crash. If, for instance, you've engineered in sort of a male dominance gene, for instance, the gene drive then enables that to sort of pass through the population, which obviously then raises some significant sort of questions that you want to ask, like, well, what happens if that trait passes to another species? What happens if, say, that invasive mouse gets off the island onto the mainland? Do we now have a problem with that? So the program that NC State is a part of, which is called this G-Bird program, which is the genetic biocontrol of invasive rodents, we're looking at this from a holistic approach. So not just if you can develop the technology, but whether or not you should actually use it if you have that tool in your toolbox.
I know. How do you come to those conclusions? Because, of course, the march of science, and you can't blame a good researcher for saying, let me finish this. Let you figure out what to do with it. But you're saying, well, let's all work together on this. Now, how does that conversation happen?
So that, at least at NC State, that conversation happens by having the conversation, right? And having that conversation early. So we're beginning to already have those conversations about what does the regulatory structure look like? What does a field trial look like if you were to do this? In essence, before the technology is actually completed. So the scientists and technology developers are part of that conversation from the beginning, along with the sort of populations and the societal questions as well. All of that is happening simultaneously. So you don't get to a situation where, oh, great, I have this gene drive sitting here waiting to go. And then we start asking those questions. We at the GES Center are trying to sort of flip that on its head and have those conversations right from the beginning.
And you are also a very strong advocate of opening that conversation even wider to include citizen scientists.
Absolutely.
Tell us more about that.
So there's been this interesting sort of phenomenon happening since, I don't know, maybe about 2008 or so around biotechnology, where there was this group of folks up in Boston primarily who, in essence, were saying, well, we're interested in biotechnology. We're interested in science. Why can't we do this as well? And so they said, we're going to do it. And so this is sort of the birth of what's been sort of referred to as the DIY bio community or the do-it-yourself biology community. And I would say there was sort of this perfect storm of events that was happening. So the access to the technology was becoming easier. In essence, the costs were coming down. You're able to acquire equipment. Crowdfunding platforms were coming online at the sort of a similar time. So people, in essence, have access to money. And so these groups started forming sort of naturally, mostly through listservs. Mm-hmm. But then around 2010, the first community biotech lab in Brooklyn, New York, called GenSpace, opened up and actually provided a space for everyone, anyday citizens who are interested in biotechnology, to actually come into this space and literally get their hands wet, exposing them to a technology that I think most people think is sort of locked away.
Is there anything that limit? I mean, this is the Wikipedia approach to science,
yeah,
in a way, right? I mean, let's let 1,000 flowers grow and get as much input as we possibly can. Is there any kind of regulation, or should there be, on the kind of work done here?
So we've been, at my previous job in Washington, we started working with this community very early. So one of the first things the community did was develop some codes of conduct, because in essence, there is no real regulation around sort of who can utilize or practice biotechnology, at least in the United States. And that really holds true for universities as well. There's no like law necessarily in terms of what's governing your research. There's guidelines and research guidelines that universities have to follow, but that's usually attached to the funding, right? And so if you remove that in essence barrier or that funding barrier, then in essence there's not necessarily rules and regulations. But the DIY community has in essence taken a self-governance kind of model and has put these sort of their own sort of codes of conduct or rules in place that they abide by because they recognize their responsibility, not just to their communities that are around them, but to the larger DIY bio community, and also just the responsibleness of using a powerful tool like biotechnology.
What do you think is the role of these communities going forward?
I think there's lots of different things, right? So there's the, you know, maybe the pie in the sky of, well, it's the next Apple, right? So the Apple computer, you know, came out of the garage. We all know that story, what happens. But I think the bigger potential here is that these community biotech labs are serving as an educational resource. So most of them teach courses about biotechnology. Mm. You can go into one of these labs and learn how to use CRISPR, for instance. And so part of what that can do is it can demystify the science or demystify a technology that I think makes it easier to have a conversation about should we be using this or how should we be using this if you can actually go and see it as opposed to just thinking it's sort of locked away right in the ivory tower of a university.
Well, yeah, if you're going to have a public policy debate and the public can't debate it because they don't know what you're talking about, that makes the debate fairly limited. And is there some danger? There's a kind of a Frankenstein fear lingering in the back of my mind about some guy in his basement
sure.
with a beaker and an X-Acto knife.
Yeah, so that's always been sort of lingering there with the DIY community, but since the very beginning, the DIY community in the U.S. has had a partnership with the FBI, a very kind of strange bedfellows kind of partnership.
Oh, is that
partnership.
Like the computer geeks on the X-Files, those guys?
In a way, yeah. So what the FBI had done was they have an outreach program where they reached out to the DIY community because there were these, and maybe rightfully so, sort of fears of someone in their basement creating sort of a bioweapon, right? Now, we think that's kind of a ridiculous scenario. For what's actually happening in these community labs. But there are, you know, biosafety and biosecurity concerns about this technology, as with many technologies. And the FBI has formed a very good relationship with the community to help introduce them to first responders in their towns or cities. And so that way, sort of the fire department or the police department know that they're there. Which is important if, say, a nosy neighbor makes a phone call and says there's these weird folks sort of
with lab.
Right. And and that has sort of been the response. And so one of the best examples is when we can bring police officers into a community lab, they immediately see the difference between a meth lab and what a community biotech lab looks like.
Now, we talked about sort of the Frankenstein approach in the basement and the possibility of a bioweapon, but the fact is, there are bioweapons perhaps being designed. I mean, a lot of research funding comes from the Department of Defense through
That's
DARPA.
Correct.
We have to, should we be concerned about this? We have to think about all of the things that could be developed under that roof.
Sure, and I think, you know, a lot of the defense spending, I would say, are at least the beginning programs, particularly in the DARPA programs, have been sort of platform building programs. So their Living Foundries program, for instance, was about sort of can we, in essence, develop 1,000 molecules or 1,000 new molecules using synthetic biology. They have a Safe Genes program, which is funding a lot of the gene drive work, including some of the work at NC State, which is looking at can you actually develop, in essence, safety mechanisms around gene drives. Now, while obviously NC State is looking at that from a conservation standpoint, the military obviously has to think about sort of if there were a threat, how could they sort of deal with that coming from a nefarious actor.
Logic
so
of defense is the best defense is an offense. The idea of not developing offensive weapons seems almost preposterous. Somebody's doing it, and if they are, you know what the logic of military defense is. I mean, it's not being critical. It's just that's the logic.
Right.
So there you have it, and those are some things we have to worry about, not just the unintended consequences, but the intended consequences, right? How do we govern those?
Yeah, I think so, and I think, you know, part of my criticism, you know, of DARPA programs that I've written about is a lot about the perception of that, right? In terms of how do we feel about, for instance, the U.S. military funding, say, a conservation effort, right? Does the U.S. military really care that much about bird species on an island? Now, if you can reap the benefits of that, I think a lot of people would make the argument then, well, we should use that funding for that purpose. But I think it enables us to actually have a larger conversation, not just about the potential sort of dual use scenarios of these technologies, but this broader question about how can we better incorporate society into these decision-making processes about whether we should develop these technologies, and if we do develop them, where and how do we use them?
Well, and even at that, the Defense Department, while it can operate under a cloak of secrecy, is still accountable as a government agency to some degree.
That's correct.
Private business can make whatever stuff they want, and if you wanted to design a more docile worker, right?
Yeah, I mean,
and you
had the
money to do it.
I think if you had the money, that would still be extremely difficult. So gene drives, for instance.
Be worth it.
Yeah, so but even with if you were able to do that, you would really probably only be able to make one of them,
mm-hmm.
right? So the way that gene drives.
They'll use their gene drive, and then they'll have them get married.
I'll sponsor the wedding.
Guess,
so the interesting thing, though, is like how many offspring could you as one individual, like in theory, make, right?
Mm-hmm.
So 10, 15, if you're lucky.
That I'm not talking.
Right?
I'm
yeah, so. Gene drives tend to work in species that, in essence, have high reproductive rates, which
All
is
right.
why people are starting to look at them in insects as one of the first models.
All right, so I'll relax on that. What about in terms of synthetic biological technologies? I can let my imagination run wild, but I'm not as experienced. What are the things that you worry about?
I think what I worry about is these unintended consequences and how the research funding models are set up. So why we tend to fund a lot in sort of the development of these technologies, what we don't fund enough in are sort of these ecological environmental implications research about what happens if you were to use these. Now, I'm a little biased. I'm an environmental scientist by training, and so we're always sort of begging for more money. But I think we need to sort of realign how we're funding some of this research and not waiting until after the technology is developed to think about some of the ecological impacts of utilizing these.
But that's a lot less glamorous when you go to Congress and ask for that.
Of course,
right?
You do not win a Nobel Prize for ecology work usually.
But getting back to sort of the DIY science, that's where crowdfunding can really be a valuable tool, I guess.
Yeah, I think if you look at a lot of the projects that some of these community labs are funding or looking to get funded, a lot of them are environmental projects that are trying to solve Good. Local problems outside the door of their spaces.
You recently attended the iGEM competition, International Genetically Engineered Machine Foundation.
Yes.
And it's a student competition. What did you find there?
So this is one of the most fascinating things that I get to do as part of my job. This is a synthetic biology competition that started in 2004 at Harvard with about 8 people. This year, just a couple of weeks ago, we had 6,000 participants from every continent across the globe, all basically under the age of 22, including high school teams and community biotech lab spaces as well, who get a kit of biological parts at the beginning of the summer and over about 3 or 4 months produce these very interesting sort of biological machines trying to solve problems, including food problems, medical problems, environmental problems, and they all come together at a jamboree over the weekend.
Is there any application in this to sort of, because I've been reading a little bit about what I'll call organic processing, organic computers essentially using organic processes rather than silicon to process information?
Maybe I'm not that familiar with that, so
yeah,
I can't really speak to that as much.
It works faster, and there's actually a hunch that perhaps nature worked just that way, that there was a little bit of quantum computing that goes on in evolution, because actually the giraffe's neck couldn't have gotten along fast
right.
enough if there wasn't some quantum understanding that we better get along
yeah,
fast.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that nature is always going to be smarter than us,
yeah.
but I think we're trying to at least get close to it.
Sounds great. Todd Kuchen is a senior research scholar at the Genetic Engineering and Society Center at North Carolina State University. You can see links to his work at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you, Todd.
Thanks so much.
Just ahead, the story of a credit union that combined lending with social justice and transformed neighborhoods turned out to be good business, too. Stay tuned.